Well, thank you so much for being here this evening. We'd like to go ahead and get started with our meeting. My name is Kent Jones. I'm the state engineer for the state of Utah and the director of the Division of Water Rights. I'm happy for the opportunity to before you tonight and talking about some of the studies that we've been doing up in this area. We've got a couple of presenters that are going to be talking about some things tonight and the study that's been done up in this area. We've kind of established a moratorium for the last few years about what we're going to be doing up here with water policy. And there's some concern about the drilling of wells and the use of groundwater and the implementation of exchange applications and just different things. So we wanted to get some good answers, and we appreciate the participation of the Utah Geological Survey, who's here tonight with us, who's going to be doing some of the presentation, and also for Weber Basin Water Conservancy District, who has helped participate in funding this study to help us get some answers, I guess, that we need to be able to make some good decisions on water management in this area. I have a lot of fond memories of the Morgan Valley area. When I was my cousin Richard here, I remember as a little kid, we used to have family reunions, and I always got to come to Morgan and go, I think it was the Lions Club or something.
Maybe Como Springs.
At Como Springs, we did that. Just a lot of fun memories coming. We got to go to Morgan's. I was always excited to come up here. Finally, the family got so big we couldn't find a building to get everybody in and had to keep moving places. But it's a lot of fun memories as I drive up here and just thinking about family get-togethers and sharing times with my relatives up here. And neat place, neat area. So I'm always glad to come back up here and try to make a point for coming through and remembering every chance I get. But I know this area is very critical to you people as far as development, as far as what goes on here, and we are not here to be your planners. We're not here to be the developers in the area, but we are here to help regulate water so that those who are making your planning decisions can do what they need to do and plan effectively, knowing that water resources are there or not there. And we'll be presenting some information. We're going to propose a policy tonight, okay, about what we think we need to do in the area, and we want to get your comment. We're going to give you some time to comment on that so that we can consider what needs to be done. There is a sign-up list back here at the corner. We want to make sure you get your contact information so that we can kind of keep you posted on what we're doing. We do have some more chairs. Those of you sitting on the back row are in violation of these notes on the wall. So if you slide your chairs off the wall about 1 inch, because we're not supposed to put them on the wall. We noticed that after someone said, no, you don't have to do that. After someone set the chairs up, we just broke the law, but we're used to doing that. So we're glad to have you here again. And the program, James, is there anything else that we needed as far as initial kinds of things? Okay, because here's what we want to do tonight. We're going to have UGS give us a presentation. Michael is going to be doing that, plus Danae's going to be helping, and they'll come up and introduce who they are and kind of talk about the study and give you the information about the things that we found out through the study process. After the UGS presentation, we're going to have Ross Hansen, who is our regional engineer for this area with the Division of Water Rights, come up and explain how we're looking at that data and how we are going to interpret that and propose a policy that we would like to administer this area up here. After that, we'll kind of open it up for comments and suggestions that you might have, and then we're going to talk about a time period and a process that we're going to follow after that. But I think we ought to move right into that. If you can kind of hold your questions till we get through with the presentations, that'll kind of help us move through the data. There's a lot of information that we'd like to present, but if you have questions, we'd like to answer them, but let's hold them until the presentations have been made, and then we'll try to address them as best we can. I had a question. Is there somebody from the Division of Drinking Water here? Great. Glad to have you here. I've just if you, people get upset, that's where you throw them. No, we're happy to have you here. And just, there are some resource people here, and I just wanted to point out we've got drinking water, we've got water rights, we've got Bureau of Reclamation, Weber Basin, we've got some resource people here that we can ask some questions if we need to. We'll try to respond the best that we can. And UGS people will be able to. But Mike, let's turn the time over to you and have you give your presentation.
Yeah. So I'm Mike Lowe. I'm the program manager for groundwater and paleontology at the Utah Geological Survey. I do groundwater, not paleontology. Don't ask me any questions about that. I'm second author on this report. Janae Wallace is the first author. She'll be doing the second half of this presentation. And Dr. Waleed Saba, who worked on the water budget portion of the report, is here if there are any questions that he needs to answer. Once again, this study was funded by the Utah Division of Water Rights, Weber Basin Water Conservancy District, and the Utah Geological Survey.
Kent did it.
Yeah.
It was working until I got up there.
So there's the title slide. Or was.
It's all fast. What did you do last time?
It's a good thing we've got some computer experts here.
Are there any questions on what we've presented?
Okay, additional authors are John King with the Utah Geological Survey Mapping Program and Kevin Thomas with groundwater paleontology. This map shows the study area that we're working with, and this is basically the drainage basin divide, except for this is where the Weber River enters at Taggart Falls, and this is the East Canyon Creek Reservoir Dam. And so the flat part of the valley is this area here, and this is where the Weber River exits at the head of Weber Canyon. Here's a photograph to show that we really did come up here while we were doing the study. And we had several major objectives when we began this study. First of all, we wanted to characterize the relationship of geology to groundwater conditions. And in order to do that, we compiled a geologic map and cross-sections. We looked at the hydrostratigraphy. That means we looked at which geologic units yielded or did not yield water. We looked at the thickness of the valley fill, the dirt that's filling the flat part of the valley that we're here on now. And then we also tried to look at whether or not those valley fill deposits that form the flat valley floor had clays or not, because clays provide some protection to pollution. And then we compiled some characteristics on how well wells would yield water from the various geologic units. We also developed a water budget for the drainage basin, and we looked at water quality. And in order to do that, we collected data from 52 wells during a study we started about 10 years ago, and then more data from 10 bedrock wells as part of the more recent study a couple of years ago. We used that data to classify the groundwater quality of the valley fill aquifer. In other words, we used it to show how good the groundwater is. And then we collected some what's called stable isotopes. These are minute changes in the number of protons to neutrons of various elements, to look at things like age and where the water was recharged. Once again, we collected this environmental tracer data for both alluvial and bedrock wells 10H.
Mike, sorry, up the screen, because you can't see the bottom.
Can you tilt it?
Yeah, tilt it.
Somebody's really tall.
Oh, gotcha.
So in order to accomplish those objectives, we produced a geologic map that was compiled from various sources, with some of the younger alluvium not shown, and this was done by John King of our mapping program. He made three geologic cross-sections so that we could look at the subsurface relationships of the geology. This is basically like taking a knife and cutting through a cake and then looking at how the layers are along that vertical transect. These cross-sections show the geology to be very complex, as I'll mention in a minute. We collected data from various well logs and from aquifer tests that have been conducted up here to look at the water yielding abilities of the aquifer materials in the valley. In order to look at the thickness of the valley fill, we did a gravity survey. And what that is we take an instrument that's very sensitive to slight changes in gravitational pull and took readings around the valley. I'll explain that more in a minute. We looked at water well logs to look at whether or not there are clay layers or not. And then we developed used a lot of complex data to develop a water budget. That was done by Dr. Saba. The gravity was done by Kevin Thomas, and as you'll find, my little piece of this study, other than helping write it, was the groundwater recharge area map. And then Janae conducted the water quality sampling over a period ranging from 2004 to 2009. And what we found is that the geologic units in the drainage basin range from Proterozoic to Holocene. They range from before life developed on this planet to recent times, and in fact, deposits are forming now. And we assigned, and basically these geologic units are on two different lithologic columns. The stratigraphy changes in the north part of the valley compared to the south because of important faults. Those faults and folds are very important in this valley in that those cake layers I told you about are really broken up and messed up and pushed around and folded up. So it's a very complex geology. We looked at the potential for fractured rock aquifers as potential targets, and we found some carbonates and some sandstones and quartzites that might be potential targets. But we also found that these targets in many areas are covered by more recent tertiary age or just post-dinosaur age rocks that aren't very good aquifers for the most part. And I'll show some more about that in a minute. So these are those lithologic columns I tell you about. And geologists break different rock layers up into different units, and we name them. And it's not important that you understand which names you are, but you can see that the layers that are colored blue here are the ones we think can yield water fairly well. And on this column, it's probably about 50-50 where you have rocks that won't yield water very well and rocks that will. This is for the most of the Morgan Valley area, is this lithologic column. And then up in the northern part, the extreme northern part of the valley, you have the Willard Fresh Sheet there. And as you can see, most of the rock units in that fresh sheet won't yield water very well. And those that do are once again shown in blue. So this is the geologic map that John King put together. And I want you to note that you've got some browns and greens and blues in the center of the map here and over on the extreme left margin here. But for the rest of the area, you've got these tertiary units, the Norwood Tuff, the clay, sticky one that has caused a lot of landslide problems around here, shown in pink, and the Wasatch Formation, shown in yellow. And what I'm trying to show here is that most of those potential bedrock aquifers that we colored blue that could be potential targets are covered by these younger units. You can't see them. So you can't predict where you're going to hit them in the subsurface. And these tertiary units are in many areas very thick, so those rock units would be out of reach of economic water wells as well. So once again, some of our conclusions. Cross-sections show that the tertiary units are thick, that the structure is complex, and that you can't predict what rock units you're going to hit with a water well drilling through those tertiary units. The flow in those bedrock units that I talked about are going to be controlled mostly by the breaks in the rock or fractures that are caused by the complex structural events that have gone through during three different time periods in the past. And as we compiled the water yielding characteristics of these fractured rock aquifers, we found that for any given rock unit, those water yielding characteristics were highly variable and unpredictable. So you don't know what you're going to get if you try to drill a fractured rock aquifer. These red and green dots here show where we got our aquifer yielding information from. The green ones are actual aquifer tests that were conducted by various consulting companies in the past and one by the Utah Geological Survey. And the red is from specific capacity of tests that water well drillers did at the time the wells were drilled. So you can see this is a sparse amount of data for the large area that's covered, but that's what there is. And basically, as we look at the geologic framework, one of the things that was easy to conclude was the valley fill aquifer, the gravels that form the valley fill here, and which have been historically developed the most with water wells, are in fact the best target for water wells. They're going to yield water the best compared to the bedrock aquifers. We found that many of the existing wells are shallow, and because the valley fill aquifer is under unconfined or water table conditions, that aquifer is very vulnerable to surface sources of pollution. We did the gravity study and determined that the valley fill, it ranges from zero thickness at the valley margins to as much as 600 feet thick in some areas of the valley, and I'll show you where they are in a minute. And then based on my little piece of work, we found that there are very few areas where you have continuous clay layers, and so you're not getting any protection from surface sources of pollution. The valley fill aquifer ranges from very low to very high, and there were estimates of even higher transmissivities for the valley fill aquifer that we felt might have problems with how they were obtained. So in our report, this is what we're using as the range, but we're acknowledging that there was one well near the river that might have been pulling river water down into it as it was pumped that seemed to yield a better transmissivity. So groundwater in the valley fill aquifer generally flows along the same direction as the Weber River or the tributary streams. So it's a very easy aquifer to predict where water is going to go in, and very easy to predict at what depth you're going to hit groundwater if you drill a well. So in order to get to the thickness of that valley fill aquifer, because the thicker the aquifer you have, the more chances you're going to have to be able to pull water in, we did that gravity survey. And all of these red dots that you see here are where we stopped and took a GPS reading and then let our gravimeter, a precision gravimeter, collect data on the gravitational signal at that point. And the reason why we do that is this instrument is so sensitive that small variations in the gravitational field can be measured, and if you have dense rock closer to the ground surface, you get a higher gravitational reading than if you have dense rock far away from where you're driven your station. In that way, we can contour information that can be translated into valley fill thickness. And this is our map. You can see that around the valley margins, the valley fill is fairly thin. But you have these three areas here where you have thicker gravel deposits. And the little orange dots there and there are where it's up to 600 feet thick. The next color out is 400 feet thick. Basically, what I did was looked for clay layers in the driller's logs, and this story is really easy. I didn't find any, so all we have is primary recharge area up here in the valley for the valley fill aquifer, and no discharge areas except for where you find the river itself and it's intercepting the ground surface. And this washed out map basically shows one color because it's just all primary recharge area. The dots show the wells that I used to make the map. Looking at how well yields are going to yield water, what we did was we first took water well logs and we looked at, combined with the aquifer test I mentioned, and we looked at how fast water was drawn down in the well compared to the pumping rate. And that gives you specific capacity. Knowing specific capacity, you can take aquifer thickness and calculate transmissivity, which is the most important number determining how well a well is going to yield water. And you can see that the darker greens here are where you would expect to find the best wells. And the lighter yellows and whites are where you wouldn't expect to have really great yields. And then you can work backwards from that transmissivity, subtract out the thickness of the aquifer, and you can come up with hydraulic conductivity, which is how well water flows between the individual gravel range. But as I mentioned, transmissivity is a more important value. And in case a groundwater model needs to be constructed for the valley fill in the future, we also calculate storativity and showed the distribution of that value. That's more important for confined aquifers than it is for unconfined aquifers. So it's not really something I would look at a lot in terms of trying to determine where most water is stored. Anytime you're doing a study, one of the more important things that you need to know is water budget. How much water is coming in and how much water is going out. And that'll tell you whether or not you're in trouble and you're using water faster than it's being replenished. In order to do that, we need to know a number of different things. One of the more important things is we need to know precipitation. The little red dots you show on here are the stream flow gauging stations. You also need to know surface flow through the valley. The green dots are the weather stations, and you can see in our study area we have one. And that's not going to be good enough for us to get a good distribution of precipitation for the valley. Precipitation varies from low elevation to high elevation with greater values in the higher elevation. So what we had to do was look at an even larger area to get a variety of weather stations at different elevations, and then using complex computer methods contour that data. And this is our precipitation map that ranges from 17 to 50 inches per year. You can see that the higher precipitation values are at the crest of the Wasatch Range, separating us from the Wasatch Front Area, which you would have expected. Another high at the higher mountains that are separating Morgan Valley from Ogden Valley. And the lower precipitation along the valley floor here, as would be expected. Another thing that you need to do to make your water budget is you need to know how much water is going out in the form of evapotranspiration, that's usage by plants, or just evaporation due to the sun. And in order to do that, we got some really good GIS data that shows integrated land use and the various types of plant communities within the drainage basin. With that map and knowing how much evapotranspiration the various plant types use, we're able to calculate net evapotranspiration out of the valley and use that to come up with our water budget. And over on the left here, this is flows into the valley. On the right, it flows out of the valley in various categories. So streams flowing into the valley are about 190,000 acre feet per year. Stream, that's from the Weaver River at Devil's Flag. Stream flow from East Canyon Creek is about 35,000 acre feet per year, and precipitation is about 436,000 acre feet per year. That's the largest component. So your total inflow is 661,000 acre feet per year. Streams leaving, you've got the Weaver River leaving, flow leaving at Gateway at 249,000 acre feet per year. You have water flowing out of the Gateway Tunnel at 91,000 acre feet per year. ET, once again, a fairly large component of 228 acre feet per year, with some additional ET from agriculture at about 30,000 acre feet per year, and a small amount of municipal and industrial use at 16,000 acre feet per year. So your total outflow is about 600,000 acre feet per year. That means that 61,000 acre feet per year less leaves the valley that came into the valley. But the reason for that is primarily evapotranspiration, because you only have a small component of use by humans. So that's the geologic framework part of the study. I'm going to let Janae Wallace come up now and talk about the water quality aspects.
Thanks, Mike. Okay, I've got the great news of the night, and that's you guys have the best water quality probably of the state, you in Ogden Valley. So if you want to submit water like Beaver did, I think you should, because you have really nice water quality here. I'm the one who actually came out here and walked around with my boots and my bucket, so I want to thank all the water owners, the well owners, for letting me come out and sample your wells, first of all. And Mike mentioned that we started this study, I started collecting in 2004. So the germ of the idea of collecting water quality information actually started about in 2002, 2003, with the help of Weber Morgan Health Department. And so I want to present the overall water quality based on samples that I took from about 50 water wells in 2004. And then I came back in 2009 and sampled some bedrock wells. I'm going to present the classification that's already been passed through the Water Quality Board a couple of years ago, and then talk about the nitrate concentrations in the valley, because we also sampled that in addition to the TDS. And then finally, what Water Rights wanted us to look at were environmental tracers in the alluvial wells and the bedrock wells to try to get an age constraint to date the water to see how old it is. Oops, went the wrong way. Okay, so first of all, the results from that 2004 study when I sampled about 50 water wells, and I also used data from Utah Division of Drinking Water and the Department of Ag and Food, who also walked around and collected some water. And that shows, the TDS ranges from 91, which is almost distilled water, it's so pure, to 1018, which is still really quite good. In fact, all the data that I collected, there was only one well that exceeded 1,000 milligrams per liter. And as you'll see in a chart that I'll present a few down, you'll see how good that water is. The average is 437 for TDS, that's total dissolved solids. And then for the bedrock wells that I sampled in 2009, the range was from 256 milligrams per liter TDS to 772 milligrams per liter, with a low average of 526 milligrams per liter. The nitrate, using that same 2004 data from the alluvial wells, was from less than 0.1 range up to 12.8 milligrams per liter. Now, the EPA standard for nitrate is 10 milligrams per liter, and there are three wells that did exceed that EPA standard, and that's the standard is set for mostly pregnant mothers and babies because it can cause problems with small children called blue baby syndrome. But my boss has been drinking 6 milligram per liter nitrate in his public supply well for a long time, and he's just fine. Sorry. and a really low average as well, 2.6 average nitrate concentration for the Louisville wells. Now, that 2009 data I came and collected from the 10 wells was less than 0.1, and up to 28 milligrams per liter was kind of a shock to find that 28 milligrams per liter, and I'll get to that later on. So the average of nine of those wells is 1.4, but including that anomalous 28 milligram per liter boots it up to 4.6 milligrams per liter, which is pretty high, but this is anomalous, and it's pretty rare. Okay, so totally four wells in the entire valley exceeded the 10 milligram per liter EPA standard, including that bedrock well, and two of the wells had arsenic concentrations that exceeded the 10 microgram per liter concentration. All right, this is the TDS map, and Mike has shown this map before. This is all the bedrock. This is the drainage basin that feeds your valley, shown in green here. Your water supply, in addition to the Weaver River and the smaller tributaries that feed your water supply, that recharge. The different color codes on here correspond to the different concentrations of TDS, and as you can see, it's mostly all green, and that's because it's mostly all good. It's mostly all less than 500 milligrams per liter. The only exception is up here in Hardscrabble Canyon, which has a few wells that are in this pink area. And there are only about three wells up in that area that are above 700 milligrams per liter. Still really good. This is the breakdown from the Utah Division of Water Quality. According to their outline for defining what a groundwater quality class is, they consider class 1A or 1B, its beneficial use is pristine or irreplaceable. And it's defined on its total dissolved solids concentration, and that's 0 to 500 milligrams per liter. And as you can see, based on that last map, most of your water falls in this area. Class 2 is called drinking water, so you're still really good because your highest is 1,000 milligrams per liter, and this spans from 500 to 3,000 milligrams per liter. So you guys have great water here. The class 3 is considered limited use. That would be used, for example, in industrial purposes, and that, by definition, is 3,000 to 10,000 milligrams per liter TDS. And then finally, class 4 is greater than 10,000 milligrams per liter TDS, and that's what you'd find like at Great Salt Lake, saline water conditions, which none of us would want to drink, right? All right, from that TDS map, that's how you come up with the classification map. And as I mentioned, this has already been through the Utah Water Quality Board and approved. And what this shows is that all this green area is your class 1, your pristine drinking water, and you've just got a teeny touch of class 2. This is only 2% of the valley fill aquifer. This represents 98%. All right, shifting to the bedrock samples that I came out in 2009 and collected. And as you notice, they are mostly situated around the margins of the valley, which makes sense because they're the bedrock areas. And Mike showed you that the isopach map for the valley fill material here, there weren't any wells that penetrate into the bedrock. So all the samples I collected for bedrock were around the margins. Two of those are springs, and one of those is Como Springs right there, I believe. And this is an unnamed spring, which we just drove past, and I guess there's new development all up in this area, huh? Surprised about that. The different size of the bubbles correspond to the TDS concentration, with the smaller bubbles, the lower concentration, and the largest bubbles, the highest concentration. And again, up here in Hardscrabble, looks like that's the highest. And again, still drinking water quality at 700 milligrams per liter. And then over here shows the geologic units that it penetrates, and most all of it comes from the Norwood Tuff, at least for the wells that I sampled. All right, shifting to nitrate concentration, this shows the both the bedrock wells and the wells that I sampled in the alluvium in 2004, shown in the red dots. Again, the bigger dots correspond to the higher nitrate concentrations. The green dots on here correspond to samples that I took in 2004 of nitrogen and oxygen isotopes. And as you'll see in a graph, where these lie, and there are only 10 of those that I took, 10 isotope samples. And that was to try to determine where the nitrate was coming from. Okay, because Weber Morgan Health Department, they came here starting in the 1990s, and they found what they considered is high nitrate concentration of 4.5 milligrams per liter. Not because that has any kind of harmful effect, but that's how they broke things down. If it was higher than 4.5 milligrams per liter, they considered it unusual. That's what stemmed the study in the first place, is they wanted to come here and find out what was causing the nitrate concentration. And so, again, about 50 water wells were sampled for nitrate concentrations, and to help out the Weber Morgan Health Department, we took these nitrogen-oxygen isotopes to see if we could find out where the nitrogen or the nitrate was coming from. This represents, can anyone say, don't look at the bottom of the screen. It's not there anymore. This is the old Wilkinson Dairy public supply. Now it's a public supply. Well, and we just went by and took a picture of the new development. I think it's called Cottonwood?
Yeah,
Cottonwood. Real nice development. Well, this has been sampled numerous, numerous, numerous times. And when I sampled in 2004, it was around 10 milligrams per liter. It's fluctuated. It's gone above the EPA standard. And nitrogen and nitrate is typically associated with feedlots and septic tanks and fertilizer. That's what it's commonly associated with. So having a high nitrate concentration here is not too surprising, because there was a feedlot there. Well, in 2009, it still was around 9 milligrams per liter. Which is kind of odd, because there's a lot of water that's flowing through this valley, flushing it out, diluting it, so to speak. So I still wonder why this still has a relatively high nitrate concentration. And that's why we took the isotopes, to try to figure that out. This is looking up hardscrabble. Probably, this is in 2004, so I'm sure there's more development there than there is shown in this picture. There's probably a house, actually, that sits here. But this had a high nitrate concentration as well. Let's see. So those 10 samples that I mentioned before, these little dots, and probably a lot of you won't be able to see them, they're all scattered around here. What I did is I took that data, the nitrogen isotope and the oxygen isotope in nitrate, and superimposed them on known fields that's been studied before where nitrate comes from. For example, this big long rectangle field here is where the concentration of oxygen and nitrogen typically show up in manure and septic waste. Well, if you notice on there, that's the biggest field of all. It's a pretty broad spectrum. If you look at this soil nitrogen, it's a much narrower window here. Okay, and then you have other things like fertilizer, ammonia, nitrate in fertilizer, nitrate in precipitation. So if it was coming from precipitation, you'd see a lot of points up here if it was coming from the rain. But we don't see them up there. Most of our samples fall all in this manure and septic box, and then overlapping the soil nitrogen box, which leaves it kind of vague. So keep wanting to push that. Oh. So let me just go back here. These are just the alluvial wells that I sampled. I did not take any nitrogen-oxygen isotope on the bedrock samples, just on the alluvial samples from the 2004 data. What we believe is happening is most of it's all coming from manure or septic waste, because there are a lot of septic tank systems in the valley, and that these on the lower end of the spectrum are probably getting diluted by more either fertilizer and rain nitrogen sources, or from nitrate fertilizer sources, and it dilutes it and brings it down into this lower range value. But we can safely conclude that it's probably coming from mostly manure and septic tank systems. Okay, and finally, this is that well in the bedrock that had the 28 milligram per liter concentration, which was an enigma to us, because it's in bedrock and you usually associate it with alluvial material because it's more porous. Why is it here? Well, I took this shot from Water Rights. They have a handy website if you haven't been there, and honed down on where the water well is located. And it looks like up here that there are some feedlots. and feedlots are associated with manure and whatnot. And there's a home there, and they could have a septic tank system. I don't know. So it could be associated with that somehow. Because here, this is Morgan Valley. This is north coming up here. And maybe you're getting a little bit of recharge up from that area. And then, likewise, I did the same thing with their topo overlay, and it shows that it looks like there's some feedlots. I don't know if it's active. I haven't been out there to see if this is an active, or if you can even call it a feedlot, but an agricultural operation of some sort that could lend itself to contribute nitrate to that well. Okay, and finally, our task for 2009 was to try to date the water to see how old it was. So I went through and I went and resampled some of the, actually the high nitrate wells from the past, and took oxygen in the oxygen and deuterium and tritium, which is associated with above ground nuclear testing in the 50s, especially in the Nevada desert, and then carbon 14, which is, allows us to date water way back, and in some cases, for example, by Tremont, we've been able to test wells that go back to Lake Bonnevillian age. But in Morgan Valley, that simply wasn't the case. Most of our carbon samples came back, and they were all considered modern, meaning less than 50 years old. Okay, I don't expect you to even look at this. This is for me to be able to tell you, these are the wells that we sampled. 10 were bedrock. 10 were from the previous alluvial samples. And if you look over here, this is where the interpretation of the ages are. It says modern mixed, modern mixed, modern mixed, modern mixed. Most of them are modern. In fact, almost all of them are modern. Here's this slide again showing you. Here's Morgan Valley. The red dots correspond to the bedrock wells where I took those environmental samples. The blue and yellow are the alluvial wells that are in the valley fill material. The blue are the alluvial wells that had an older component to them, not old, but older than the yellow dots. If I point out the yellow dots, those are mostly in the thick of the valley fill material. The bedrock wells are shown in red. There should be two. All of these C's are for bedrock wells. Those are the carbon wells that we dated. All of them turned out to be modern water, less than 50 years old in the bedrock samples. You would expect older water to occupy the bedrock samples, but in this case, they're all modern age. This is the tritium. Again, that's from above ground testing. And this shows the wells that were sampled. I lumped them here, the bedrock samples. You can see they're varied. They go across the area. The higher tritium units, this means you have more modern water. If they plot up here, you have mixed water component. And then down here represents your older samples. So those two bedrock wells that I pointed out that we also took carbon samples, they have both a mixed signature of pre-1952 water, but also younger. So they're considered the mixed samples. But it's still relatively young. It's still less than 50 years old, or maybe 60 years old. So to conclude, based on our tritium and our carbon, you guys have young water because it's flushing through. It may be a little bit older in the bedrock samples because they're slower to receive the water because the water percolates more slowly through them, as Mike emphasized, compared to the valley fill alluvium where the gravel and the water is just rushing through, and you might have more influence from the river systems there contributing to the groundwater. Oops. Okay, so to conclude, you guys have some of the best water in the state, pristine. Should put it up for an award like Beaver did. Overall, you have really low nitrate concentration, especially for a rural area. If you compare yourself to Cache Valley or San Pete Valley has a huge nitrate concentration there. Well, compared to yours, they're around 4 milligrams per liter background because they don't get as much water. You have a lot of dilution going on. Our nitrogen-oxygen isotopes showed that it's mostly coming from manure and septic tank. You can't pinpoint either one. Because waste from humans and animals give the same signature. And then based on the environmental tracer data, the water's really old, really young, whether it's in the bedrock or whether it's in the alluvial fill material. Okay. And I'm going to let Mike conclude because you can answer the
questions. I think we'll take questions. So what did we just tell you? We told you that the geology up here in Morgan Valley is very complex and that it would be very hard to target fractured rock aquifers because of that complexity of the geology and the fact that those aquifers are covered with thick tertiary units. We told you that the valley fill is going to be a safer target for water wells and it's going to be generally more productive. So it makes more sense to concentrate on developing water wells in the valley fill even if you have to pipe the water uphill. We determined that there are three areas of fairly thick valley fill deposits and that the thickest valley fill deposits are about 600 feet. We determined that the most of the valley fill is coarse grain. That means it yields water well. It also means that your aquifer is vulnerable to pollution from surface sources. And this causes some concern with the large number of septic tanks in the valley and the shallow nature of some of those wells. And we produced a water budget which indicates that inflows exceed outflows. And I think Dr. Saba wants me to point out that those numbers are pretty close to the same number. That difference is actually small when you look at the numbers we come up with. And it may be within the margin of error of the information we had developed the budget. So, Ross, I guess we used up enough time.
There are some chairs up here, too, if anybody else wants to come sit down up here.
Okay. First off, I want to thank you guys for coming tonight. It's always good to see a lot of people out and interested in the water resources in their area, gain some knowledge and information so that we can all get on the same page. I think it makes all of our jobs easier as we try to do what we need to do. My name's Ross Hansen. I serve as the regional engineer for the Division of Water Rights. I'm responsible for the Ogden and Weaver River drainages, as well as the West Desert, which includes the Tooele County, parts of Miller County, and parts of Juab County. What I want to do today, let's see if I can find my presentation. Hopefully it'll all come up here. Okay. What I want to do is explain why we're here to do this presentation first and foremost. Back in 2007-2008, we were the area was undergoing significant population growth, and the concerns about the water resources started to arise. Because of that, we contracted with Utah Geologic Survey to conduct a study in the area. There was a meeting held here in 2008, which kicked that study off. And they released that study in March of 2011. And today, we're here to talk about the effects of the study on water right administration of the groundwater, the water resource here in the Morgan Valley. So that's why we're here. I know you've seen this before. Mike just threw it up. It's from their study. But I want to draw a quick distinction because it's going to become important as I go through my presentation. Just want to draw a quick distinction between the valley fill aquifer. Again, Mike and Janae did a good job of doing that. Valley fill aquifer and the bedrock aquifer. I'm going to be really hitting on that as we go. The lighter is the valley fill. The darker or more tinted gray is the bedrock aquifer. And I think we're going to hit some significant points on that. So, okay, what we're going to do is discuss the Division of Water Rights pertinent findings in the UGS report. We're going to talk about the water budget a little bit. I know everybody's got a lot of things to do and want to be home with their family, and so do I, especially being up here presenting, so I'll hurry and hopefully I'll be able to get some important information to you and we can get out of here. So, anyway, I want to talk about the methods of obtaining the right to use water in the Morgan Valley from here on forward. And I also want to describe, because I get a lot of phone calls about exchange applications and there's a lot of confusion surrounding that, I want to get into the fundamentals of exchange applications for just a minute. I won't bore you with it too much. And then what I want to conclude with is the state engineer's proposed policy on going forward and administering the water rights in the Morgan Valley. Okay? Start out with some vocabulary and acronyms that I'm going to use in the presentation. I guess take a look at that for a minute. If you have any questions about any of them, let me know. I'll just point out a couple that seem to confuse people. The acre foot. Anybody that doesn't know what an acre foot is, what it is it's a volume of water that covers 1 acre of land 1 foot deep. Also, I would also point out, because this seems to be somewhat of a confusing thing, the state engineer's office is also known as the Division of Water Rights. Most of you know that, but that gets confused every once in a while. Okay, with that, does anybody have any questions on any of that so far? Okay. What I wanted to do is take a look at some of the pertinent water right information that's given in the UGS report. I want to draw a distinction between surface water and groundwater as I move through this presentation, and it's important that we recognize, hopefully I won't screw that up and intermingle the two terms, but the surface water inflow, according to the UGS report that was just talked about, is 225,000 acre feet annually into the Morgan Valley. This is surface water inflow. The surface water outflow, meaning that leaving the canyon to go down to Ogden, is 342,000 acre feet. The difference being 117,000 acre feet of water, meaning that the river, the creek, the East Canyon Creek and the Weber River are accreting 117,000 acre feet of water as it passes through the Morgan Valley. Okay? Surface water. I want to make that clear. Also in the UGS report, it points out that the in-valley precipitation is much, much greater than the valley depletion, meaning the depletion that occurs in the valley due to evapotranspiration, municipal and industrial uses and such, is much less than what actually falls into your groundwater system based from precipitation, okay, and snowmelt. Also wanted to point out or bring out from the UGS study that, and Mike showed you this is definitely repetitive, but it's worth mentioning. You've got up here in the Morgan area, the aquifer, the valley fill aquifer is up to 600 feet deep. I wanted to show you this one number here. According to the report, it says there's about 170,000 acre feet of water beneath us that could be recovered. So that there's no confusion as I go through the presentation, that 170,000 acre feet of water is recoverable, but if we recovered it, we would be mining groundwater.
Maybe we recovered it out of this basement.
There you go. So we would be mining groundwater. Possibly we would compress the aquifer and it wouldn't be able to rebound. So we can't take that much water out. It's not the safe yield. That is the amount that could come out. That's the amount of water that's down there that would come out under the force of gravity, basically. It's a specific yield. Also, good quality. The report talks about the good quality of the water and the good transmissivity of the water. Now, bedrock, again, drawing the distinction between the valley fill aquifer and the bedrock aquifer, as Mike explained, the bedrock aquifer is highly, it's fractured, meaning it has joints, cracks, faults in it, some of those yield water, some of those cracks, some of those fractures don't, and Mike pointed that out in his presentation as well, so we're going to talk more about that too. Okay. In order for the state engineer to make some decisions or administer the water rights in the area, we had to take the report and derive and isolate the groundwater component from the surface water component. Most of the development that is being requested in the Morgan Valley is new wells going into the aquifer. And so we have to figure out, is there water in those aquifers or is there not water in those aquifers? So one of our staff members tore into this and used the simple equation up there of river accretion, meaning the gain of the river is equal to the summation of the outflow of what's going out of the river, out down Weber Canyon, minus the summation of the inflows, what's coming into the valley via East Canyon and the Weber River up at Devil's Canyon. Devil's Slide, I guess is what it's called. This staff member used data from 2005. The reason he used data from 2005 to do this isolation of the groundwater from surface water is that was a year of average precipitation. It was a year where we had good records, good data from the commissioner's reports, the diversion records, and we have good records and good data from the measuring devices at the inflows and outflows of the valley. So using that data, what he did was he isolated the he eliminated the precipitation and any days that had precipitation and any days that had runoff showing up in those gauging stations at the Gateway Canal and Devil's Slide and East Canyon. Doing that, he was able to determine that there is an approximate daily accretion to the Weber River of 183 acre feet per day from the Valley Fill Aquifer. Okay? So, that being said, the Valley Fill Aquifer is full and it is filling into the Weber River. Okay? Using the analogy of a bathtub, we've got recharge coming into the Valley Fill Aquifer from precipitation and at the valley margins due to infiltration of the creeks and the irrigation system water. Okay? Seeping out, if you go back to that number, that 183 acre feet per day, again, that's an approximate evaluation, but what we're approximating the annual volume that's leaving the aquifer, leaving the bathtub and going into the Weber River, it equals approximately 59,000 acre feet annually. Now, just to put that into perspective, we have 4,400 acre feet of water approved or perfected applications that are drawing from the groundwater system in the Morgan Valley. So again, just to put that into perspective, this is 4,400 acre feet we've already approved and perfected in the Morgan Valley out of the groundwater system for use. And we figure, our calculations are showing us that there's 59,000 acre feet of water seeping from the bathtub into the Weber River, from the aquifer into the Weber River. Okay? So, having said that, we know there's some water. Now, how do we obtain the right to use it? Morgan Valley is part of the Weber River drainage basin, as you know. And the Upper Weber River drainage basin was closed to new appropriations in the mid-1960s. Okay, meaning nobody can come into our office and say, hey, can I have some free water? No new appropriations since the mid-1960s. To use water in Morgan Valley, you're going to have to go through one of two channels. You're either going to have to acquire existing water rights and file a change application on those water rights, which means you're going to have to relinquish the historic use of the water when you put the water to a new use. In other words, if a farmer or a rancher owns 10 acres of ground, he wants to sell you a water right to develop some homes, he's going to have to stop using his 10 acres of water, let that dry up, while you move the water and use it in the new homes. Okay? In other words, no new appropriations of water. The other way of obtaining the right to use water in the Morgan Valley is the more common way, which is through exchange applications. And that's what we're going to talk about next is exchange applications. Exchange application basics, real quick. I just want to spend some time on this because, like I said, we get a lot of phone calls in our office about this, and the more people know and the more understanding we all have, the more efficient we're going to be. The idea behind exchange applications here in the Weber River Basin is that Weber Basin Water Conservancy District, the Bureau of Reclamation, constructed reservoirs. In those reservoirs, they collect winter water. Okay? That will allow, now that they've got that water stored up behind those dams, that allows for a person that wants to undertake a new use of water in the Weber River, they can now make an exchange application with us to where they go under a contract with Weber Basin Water Conservancy District to make it so that they can draw water from their new point of diversion at their new place of use, and Weber Basin can allow water to flow out of the reservoir to compensate the downstream users. By downstream here, we're meaning Ogden Valley, or sorry, the Wasatch Front, places down there that would not have the water. If you take it out of the groundwater, Weber Basin then is going to have to lift their gate a little bit on their reservoir and let some water go down to compensate for it. That is the basis of an exchange. Okay, now, because of the confusion surrounding an exchange, I just want to go over real quick the perfecting of an exchange application. First, if you want to do an exchange application, you will need to enter into a contract with Weber Basin Water Conservancy District. You'll need to pay for that contract. You'll need to then bring that contract and a map showing your new place of use and your new point of diversion down to our office, where you will file what's called an exchange application. You then take that exchange application once we approve that exchange application, you then take that application or take and construct the works that you were proposing. An example would be a person wants to build a new home on his granddaddy's 10 acres of land, and he doesn't have any water for that home, and he'd like to irrigate a little grass outside the home. So he goes down to Weber Basin, he contracts with them for an acre foot of water, brings that down to us, and asks us to allow Weber Basin to lift their gate a little bit while he takes out an acre foot of water out of his well, lift their gate a little bit, and send an acre foot of water down the river to compensate downstream users. If we approve that, you go ahead and construct that well. That person would go ahead and construct that well, and then he would be responsible to file proof of beneficial use, which means, hey, I constructed my well, I built my house, and I put my little bit of grass outside. I'm using the water. We will field verify that proof of beneficial use, and then we will issue a certificate which will perfect the water right. Last step in the process would be for the person that effectuated that change to continue to pay the annual contract. If you stop paying your annual contract, then you've lost the basis of your water right, and we would be forced to lapse the exchange application at that point. Any questions on that? Maybe I better stop right there for just a second. Any questions on exchange applications that I can answer for you?
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
You say you can take the transfer water, I say, from Echo Reservoir.
Okay.
And then I can drill, I get approved from you, Beaver Basin, I drill it. Drill a well and take out that from my aquifers down below.
Yes, sir.
That water doesn't transfer. Even though you open up that head gate, that water goes down the river, down the place that he's someplace.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really replace that aquifer that he's dragging that water out.
Okay. Now, remember what we talked about at the first. We talked about the fact that the bathtub's full. As we calculate
it. Is that bathtub underground or is that on top?
It's underground. It's the valley fill aquifer that I'm using the analogy of the bathtub with.
So you're telling me that the reservoirs, the East Canyon and the Echo is filling up that bathtub?
I'm telling you that as long as there's water spilling out of that bathtub into the Weber River, if you take an acre foot of water out of that bathtub, then Weber Basin Water Conservancy District can replace that acre foot in the river.
I don't buy that because I don't think that water is going down to that aquifer. When you go home tonight, you drive past in the mouth of the canyon, look at those gravel pits down there.
Now remember, I didn't say that it was going down. I didn't say it was replenishing the aquifer.
Well, that's why I asked you if that bathtub was down underground.
Right. The bathtub is replenishing the Weber River.
Well, that's on top.
Right. So if you take an acre foot out of the aquifer, and it won't any longer spill into the Weber River, okay? So then Weber Basin's going to put an acre foot of water into the Weber River for you.
How does it get down to the ground?
It's not. It's not.
That's my point. We transfer that, we exchange it, but water doesn't exchange. So we're still sucking out of that underground aquifer, but you're not replacing that.
Okay.
With real water.
And I understand your concern, and I'd like to talk to you after if I could, if that would be possible, because the bottom line is, I'm not telling you that we're replacing the water in the aquifer. I'm telling you we're replacing the water in the river for the downstream user.
But you're sucking, but you're giving somebody approval to suck it out of the aquifer.
And the reason we're doing that is because we feel our calculations show that there is water spilling out of that aquifer. Out of the bathtub, into the river.
The underground aquifer?
Yes, sir.
Another question.
Okay, go ahead.
This has to do with the annual contracts. Historically, the annual contracts price has varied from contract to contract. And also, my main question is there certainty as far as if you hold a contract for a period of time, will the price ever increase? Is it a fixed cost?
It's a good question. I'm going to have to defer that to Weber Basin Water Conservancy District personnel. Can you help us with that, Dave?
Cover now. The price that you pay does depend on when you came in. Say you contracted back in 1970. Mm-hmm. The price is different than if you contracted last year. But there's always a difference between those two as you go forward. Okay. And the only increase that you'll see to your 1970 water is a minimal, well, it's not minimal, it's a small O&M charge increase occasionally that gets attached to that. Yeah. But that same percentage gets attached to that the 2010 guy too. So you're always going to be that far behind that one that you did.
What's the average annual increase? Do you have that?
On the...
Sure.
Not even a dollar an acre foot for the project water for the earlier ones. The newer water would be just over a dollar an acre foot per year.
Okay. Yeah.
That's on average. For instance, the last 2 years we've had zero.
Okay.
One more question. I'm sorry. One more question, and I'll move on with it, and then we'll go to the end and ask some more. I thought we'd get into the exchange application questions right now and then get to the end of it. Go ahead.
Someone in the South Weber Riverdale area told me there's an aquifer there that in recent years has actually been draining and going out. So if the bathtub is overfilling, why is that aquifer outside of the mouth of Weber Canyon decreasing in volume, if in fact that's a true statement?
I don't know if that's a true statement. Okay. Our numbers are showing...
So you're saying the aquifer that's in the South Weber Riverdale area is fine and dandy?
Tell me where you're talking. South Weber Riverdale.
There's a name for it. I'm sure I'd have to look it up. He actually named the name of the aquifer. And he said
Roy.
Yeah. Oh, we're down in the Wasatch Front?
Right.
Oh, okay.
So if all this water's coming down, this bathtub's spilling over, why would that aquifer be going down? I guess
And I guess the answer to that question is there's always localized interferences going on between wells. Cones of depressions come into play and so forth and so on. I don't know anything about that particular aquifer down there
to
be able to answer it. Okay, thank you. Let's keep moving and we'll get to some more questions at the end.
Ross, I just thought I'd input one thing, and that is though Weber Basin is the source of most of the water that's used for exchanges, there could be another entity such as Davis and Weber's storage up in East Canyon. So I think they're an example, and they account for 95% of the exchanges, but there are other entities.
That's right. Okay, so all right. Now having talked about the exchanges, having talked about the fact that we believe there's some groundwater spilling into the Weaver River, we now need to talk about our proposed policy for the Morgan Valley. Just to put everybody's minds at rest, there is no real earth-shattering information here. We do want to clarify some things, and we do want everybody to understand what it is we're going to be doing with applications when they come into our office. First and foremost, there has not been since 1965 or 66, and there still is not going to be any new appropriations. We propose that there not be any new appropriations of water in the Weaver River Basin. That's nothing changed. We propose that we continue, and this is where the distinction between the Bedrock Aquifer and the Valleyfield Aquifer starts to come into play. We propose that we continue to allow exchange applications for wells that are drilled in the Valleyfield Aquifer and for direct diversions from the river. Okay? Now, here's where we need some clarification. It's not a change. This is how we've been trying to handle the water rights, although there's been a lot of confusion in our office and in the public, but I just want to put this out on paper so that everybody can see it. Again, this is a proposed way of administering the water rights in the valley. As far as the Bedrock Aquifer goes, and I've got a schematic on from the UGS study on the next slide that I'll get into this just a little bit deeper so that we can all understand. But as far as the Bedrock Aquifer goes, first and foremost, you need to know that there's no guarantee, like Mike said, there's no guarantee that you're going to hit a water-yielding fracture when you try to punch a well into the Bedrock Aquifer. Okay? Now, reading that bottom one, and again, I'll get into the schematic of it. A lot of you can't see it. I see people standing up trying to read it, but I'll read it. It says, you will need to demonstrate to the state engineer that groundwater is not contributing to the flows of a surface source which does not receive a full year supply. In other words, you would need to show us a study that you're not going to affect a surface water source that is fully appropriated. Now, I'll show you a schematic of that. Again, thank you to UGS for this. Is a great schematic block diagram. It really does a great job of explaining what I need here. Anyway, let's take Cottonwood Creek for an example. As you can see, here's the Valleyfield Aquifer. The yellow line represents the margin between the Valleyfield Aquifer and the Bedrock Aquifer. Down here, we would, of course, consider the application on its own merits, but we don't see a whole lot of reason to reject applications other than localized interference issues. We don't see a lot of reasons to reject applications for new wells in the Valleyfield Aquifer. Okay? Going up the canyon, talking about the Cottonwood Creek area, let's say that somebody wanted to punch a well right there, where my pointer is showing.
Snow Basin.
Okay, Snow Basin. And we know that the waters of Cottonwood Creek are fully appropriated, and we also know that the creek runs dry toward the end of the irrigation season. In other words, the irrigators are not receiving their full supply of water. So if somebody would like to punch a well up in this area, they would need to show us, okay, they would need to prove to us that the fractures that they're going to intercept when they punch that well are not contributing to the flows of Cottonwood Creek. Okay? If they're contributing the flows to the Cottonwood Creek, we have to do a lot more homework and a lot more research in order to approve that application. Why? Because Cottonwood Creek is fully appropriated and they're not receiving their full supply of water already. You will further reduce that surface source by punching a well in that Bedrock Aquifer. Can you show us that it's possible to do? Yes. By study, you could show us that. So we are definitely not closing. I just want to make this very clear. We are not saying you can't do a well in the bedrock aquifer. Okay? It's just going to be a little more difficult because we need to understand what's going on. Okay, where you can go to get more information. The UGS study that Mike just referred, or that Mike and Janae just presented to you, I recommend that everybody take a look at that and get as much information as they can from it. You can also go to our website at the Division of Water Rights, which is waterrights.utah.gov. If you need help, I've got my phone number here. I think I've got my phone number up here in a minute. But if you need help, you can certainly call our office. If you need help finding your way around that website, there is a lot of information on our website. And you do have access to all the information we have access to. So if you need help navigating it, you're more than welcome to call our office. Again, what I've talked about today is a proposal. We are proposing that this is how we administer the water in the Morgan Valley going forward from here. We are requesting and asking for your written comments on the proposal. We would gladly accept them and gladly consider them in our decision-making process. There's our address. It's Post Office Box 146300. There's a fax number there if you'd like to fax something. We do want the comments written, though. We don't want comments. Don't think that if you call us and talk to us for a minute on the phone that you've submitted a comment. Please write them and send them so we can include them in the record. There's my email address. It's rosshanson@utah.gov. And I just put that little text down at the bottom that says, please identify subject as comments on Morgan Valley policy. If you don't do that, I'll probably throw the email away from spam. It's just, I can't keep it all straight, so I get too much email as it is. But if you'll put that in there, I will print it out and we'll put it on the record. Okay? All right. Now, before I open it up to questions, I got to tell you who's here. We've got Weber Basin Water Conservancy District that's going to help me answer questions. I got the state engineer and state engineer staff here that's going to help me answer questions. I'm probably not going to be able to answer all your questions. And then we also have the gentleman from Division of Water Quality if we get into some water quality questions or issues that we need to answer. And, of course, you got UGS here that would fill those geology questions as well. I guess, do you want me to take the questions or do you want to? All right, let's...
You're doing really great, Ron.
Go ahead.
The first item you had on the exchanges is 1 acre foot. Historically, you assumed that 1 acre foot was a house on 1 acre. Now we're seeing houses on smaller lots that are required to have 1 acre foot. Has there been consideration to let Weber Basin sell or exchange or rent smaller...
Smaller quantities of water than an acre foot.
Because some homes, you talked about, we're aware of homes that actually have secondary water. So you've got a half acre lot with 2 acre feet of water committed to it. So would that be a thing that the state would consider to allow them to make the water go farther?
That actually is bordering on a Weber Basin Water Conservancy District policy, so I'm going to let Tage chime in on that. But as far as we're concerned, I just need to throw some data out to you real quick. A house, we look at a house as requiring or needing 0.45 acre feet of water per year. We also look at the irrigation of land here as needing 3 acre feet per acre. So it doesn't take a lot of grass to use up 1 acre foot of water if you include that 0.45 acre feet of water for the home. So I just wanted to point that out. And then I'm going to ask Tage and...
Well, can I add a caveat to that? Up in the Gardner subdivision, they were going to build some homes. They were large fourplexes on a small lot. So those homes, that water company would require them to have 4 acre feet.
I understand.
And so that's the basis of the question.
Okay.
To address directly what you said about our subdivision, I'm on the water board there, and we're currently allocating 0.45 acre feet per household. So on the fourplex, we'd add about 1.8 acre feet attributed to the fourplex. And that's how we've been allocating it.
Okay. I think, I'm not sure, Tate, don't let me speak for you here, but I think you guys have an interior policy about issuing 1-acre-foot contracts. Is that correct?
It's actually a good question Ray's asking, because it's changed. The landscape up here has changed some since the time. This dates back to the old Bureau of Reclamation contracts. They were issuing only in 1-acre-foot increments. And so as we released water out of these federal facilities, that's what they were requiring. However, since we've gone into this moratorium, since the study's been going on, we've been reviewing that in depth and concluded that if the subdivision has secondary water in it, and there's an outdoor application that's beyond what the well is going to produce for indoor, that we're going to consider going to half acre foot increments so that we can accommodate that. But if it's going to be used for both indoor and outdoor use, your 3 acre feet per acre is still pretty close.
Yeah.
And then there might not be a need to do that. But if you have a secondary use, or secondary supply, sorry, for residential lots, and we're only exchanging water for an indoor use culinary well, then we're going to consider going to smaller acre.
Okay. Now I want Kent to chime in on that just a little bit. I don't think we have a problem with them going to a lower amount of water, but I better ask you.
We don't. No, but the numbers that Russ talked to you about, we will look at your beneficial uses, and we're going to say you need to have enough water to supply whatever you want to put your water to use for. So the 0.45 for family, we'll look at the size of your yard, and we're going to say you need this number of acre feet to supply your yard. If you're really wanting to get out and mow 5 acres of lawn, we're going to tell you 5 times 3, it's 15 acre feet plus 0.45, that's what you're going to have water available in order to supply what you want to do. So you'll need to, you just look at that. But we don't have a problem with going something less than that. But I know administratively it's difficult for Weber Basin to kind of look at.
Yeah, when it gets tough for us is if a developer comes in and wants a certain amount of acre feet of water for a certain amount of lots, and then all of a sudden the number of lots change with the amount of acre feet in the contract change. That's where we get messed up. But in general, I think we're going to entertain the smaller increments, even for the development that has more lots in it.
And we would not have a concern with that. We'll just look at the water requirements and that's how much water you've got to have to meet your requirements.
So did that answer your question? I've got another one back here. Sure. Go ahead.
I just want to be sure. You're saying the 4.5 acre feet is for just in your home.
0.45. So less than a half of an acre foot.
Right. That's
okay.
For just inside my home.
Yes.
So if I have one of these houses, that's what I'm allocated for, then I have no water for any kind of grass or anything. Is that right?
If you've got an acre foot contract and you've got a home, you do have some water for irrigation outside and have some grass. Not a lot. I want to say it's... It's 0.18, isn't it? That's what I thought. It's approximately 0.18. I think that's with animals. I mean, I think that's house, animals, and 0.18 acre, is it? Or is that house only?
I think.
Okay. So you do have some room for some grass within that acre foot of water that you've contracted.
So, but if I have no secondary water supply, then and I'm given 0.45 acre feet for my lot, and it doesn't matter what size my lot is, then I really don't have any outdoor water at all.
If you've got a 0.45 acre foot contract and it is for a home, that is what you should have, is just the home and not any outdoor irrigation. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
I've read some studies recently about the average household water actually going down now for the first time in history. Is the state looking at possibly reducing the 0.45 acre feet requirement?
Tough question.
In the early 1980s, the requirement for drinking water for inside use only in a home was 0.73 acre foot per home. And it's a number that the old connections, that's what we used to look at. And we actually got with the Division of Drinking Water, the standard changed sometime that then went. I can't remember from the gallons, and it is like 400.
I think it is 400 gallons per day.
Requirement right now, but it used to be more than that, and we made a reassessment of this is really what we're using. I know there's a very concerted effort in the state right now to stress conservation of water, to do everything you can to use low flush toilets and restricted shower heads and things that kind of restrict that. And we are seeing some great success in the state. The Division of Water Resources has got a whole program that we're pushing, and I know Weaver Basin is pushing that, looking at conservation yards and different things to help restrict water use and help conserve this precious resources that we've got. We are not talking right now about reducing that number yet, but that's not outside the realm of possibility. That could be done. There are some subdivisions we've actually had come into the Division of Water Ex and show that their subdivision as a whole is using less than the standard amount, and they've actually got some exemptions through the Division of Drinking Water and through our office to justify some lower flow requirements for inside use only. When they've been able to meter and show that that's consistent and historic record, well, they'll show that. We will consider the information, but if you don't have that, we've got to go with the standard numbers. And the standard number is not being discussed about being altered yet, but it could be.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
What would it take for that bathtub to start going dry? Where is the water coming from? If the river isn't filling that bathtub, and then that bathtub starts running, stops tipping, what happens? How much?
Well, it's a very good question. First off, according to the UGS report, we see that bathtub filling up from precipitation, runoff, at the valley fill margins where the runoff can enter into the bathtub, if you will. You also get some seepage from the river, but we're seeing just the opposite here. The bathtub's dumping into the river. The river is accreting here through the Morgan Valley. And the answer to your question, the direct answer is, worse, our numbers right now, the best data we have available to us, is showing that that will stop spilling after we use 59,000 acre-feet of water. That's what our numbers show right now. Now, can we get better numbers? Possibly. Can that come down? Possibly. But that's what our numbers show at this point.
The number of acre-feet that we're using right now, Ross?
4,400 acre-feet from the groundwater system.
Okay, and that's a number we're kind of comparing. Now, we've got 4,400 that we're using compared to 59,000 that appears to be coming out. That's a big difference. So we're saying, well, should we shut things down? What it's telling us is that we're not utilizing that groundwater resource anywhere near close to capacity of what it can do. But will we continue to monitor it? Yes, we will. We'll watch that. But it just shows a lot more water coming through here than we've actually allocated through applications.
Yes, ma'am.
Were you surprised at the end of the study?
I don't know that we were necessarily surprised, because I haven't, I mean, other than localized interference where you've got a cone of depression from one well reaching over and interfering with another well. Localized interference issues, we see some poorly constructed wells that are maybe 50 feet deep or 10 feet deep or who knows what, that have struggled or had some problems, but for the most part we're not seeing water levels decline in wells. So, go ahead.
So how many acre feet is available for use of the homeowner or developer?
Right now, with our rudimentary study that we've done, okay, not UGS's, ours, that we did in-house on the when we isolated the groundwater component, the bathtub, from the surface water stuff, we're showing that there's 59,000 acre feet of water. All that is doing for us right now is giving us the warm and fuzzy that we're okay to continue to allow development of the groundwater resource. We're not saying, I don't believe we're saying that by any shape of the imagination we're going to allow 59,000 acre feet of water to come out of that groundwater source at this point. But right now, we got 4,000 coming out of it. We're showing 59,000 spilling out of the Valley Fill Aquifer. Why not continue to allow some development? That's how we're looking at it.
How much does Weaver Basin water have?
How much water behind their dams do they have that they could release?
How many can they sell?
That's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, I don't even know if they know.
Well, we do know it's finite.
Yes, it's finite.
And we do know it's not anywhere near 59,000.
Right.
What we think we have is what we projected is a supply for what's projected for development in the Morgan Valley for the next 25 years.
Which is how much?
Which is somewhere around the 15,000, not...
Yeah, if you figure we've only developed 4,400, we're not going to get up to that 59,000 acre foot number. Besides that, a very good question, by the way. They don't have 59,000 acre feet.
It isn't that we don't know. It's that we're trying to acquire more so that you have it available when you need it. Our job is to stay out ahead of the growth so that we have it when you need it. And so it might be 10 today and 15 in 3 years from now and 20 years from now.
So when Weber Basin says you have limited amounts, you better come in and buy your acre feet, and now all of a sudden you've got thousands of acres of feet you can sell?
No, what we're saying is number one, if right now we have a certain amount that's available, and if we're going to have more, we're going to have to go out and acquire it and develop it and charge more for it than we are presently. And what we're also saying is that if you're out in this bedrock aquifer, we've been told we've talked about this for a decade now, almost 10 years now, that there might be a limited finite amount in that bedrock aquifer. And so we've always said that about outside of the river basin. Now what I'm hearing tonight is that you're not going to be limited if you can find the water. But up until now, we've been told that there's something less than that.
This would be another question from Weber Basin. Is you have some agriculture water under contract.
Right.
Would you buy those back or convert them, or could they be part of that exchange water?
Yeah, right now, under the federal contract, we can't just switch it over from agriculture to municipal water supplies. And so the process is we have to go back through what we call the NEPA process, which is that we have to make a request to the feds. And then they put us through an environmental assessment process that may include a whole what you call EIS, an environmental impact statement, which will probably cost us millions of dollars in a couple of years at least to get that converted. But to answer your question, I think that's where we're headed. The time when those of you that have federal water irrigating your lands want to convert that water over to the next use, then we're going to have to go to that expense and convert it.
Okay. I wanted to make one point. We've had a lot of discussion about exchange applications. The statute actually says in Section 7333 that anyone entitled to the use of water has the right to change the point of diversion, the place and nature of use of that water. And that's a lot full state. Now, it doesn't say you have to go to Weber Basin to get a water contract. It says if you have a right to use water, that could be an irrigation company water right, it could be a private water right. I mean, you may have your own water rights, or others may have water rights. There are other sources to use that anybody that has a water right has the right to be able to change the point of diversion, place, and nature of use. And so you can actually use water rights. Weber Basin has been set up to help supplement the whole river system, help supply water, and help meet future needs, and they're doing a great job doing that. And that is a good source to be able to go get water and use water. But there are other options in the basin. There are other water rights that already exist in the basin that you can look at. You know, some irrigation company shares are a thing that's starting to move now. There's a lot of concern about giving control of the shares and can we move that kind of water. But the statute actually allows that. It requires permission of irrigation companies to do that and get involved, unless you get a Supreme Court ruling about your entitlement to use water beneficially, and then you don't have to ask the person that owns the water. It was just I'm a little angry about a recent Supreme Court ruling. but I didn't want that to come out, but we're working through that trying to help preserve the water rights system, but I just wanted to let you know there are other options you can look at for water, but I think Weber Basin is a very good source.
Chad, just so everybody knows, we're fine with that. We do not have enough water to supply this valley through build out, and I don't know what build out is, but if you figure this is going to be an urban area one of these days, some would argue that they won't want that. That's fine too, but we don't have enough water for every use this far out of the valley as you can see. What we need is these other sources to start converting over along with us. And that doesn't mean any income to us, which is fine. What we need is a master plan up here that allows that conversion to take place so that we're not draining reservoirs all in one place and have the rest of it go dry.
This is a trend we're seeing all around the state right now, is conversion of ag water to M&I water as more people are moving in. I remember several years ago talking to Uncle Ray about the property that they had associated with the farm. And he says, yeah, there's a lot of land up there. No, it's not available for subdivision ones. So I don't know if that's changed. I'll keep looking. I'm pretty concerned with the farm, but I just remember telling me that one day, you know, it's not available for subdivision because it's a farm. They're operating a farming operation. But we're seeing around the state a transition of ag waters being moved into M&I to meet subdivision needs and town needs.
I don't want to beat this to death, but the other thing is, Randy asked a question about federal water being converted. Anybody that's getting water out of Echo Reservoir, that's the old project, the 1930s project. That is all agriculture water, and that would take that federal action I was just telling you about, literal act of Congress, to get that changed over to use for urban water. So anybody that's using Echo water has that same federal issue.
And that's something we weren't really tuned into for a while. And we started to have exchanges come up on that water. We started to approve them, and the Bureau of Reclamation raised a hand and said, hey, there's some federal laws here that are being violated. You need to be careful. And so we've actually stepped back and said, yeah, we can't do that until this whole process goes through. And so we backed off on that, trying to be careful with that.
On going back to the point of diversion, is if you want to divert, to change the point of diversion, do you lose a certain percentage of what you have, a 20%, or what do you lose any of that?
There are a lot of things that come into play. So when people change water rights, it says you should be able to change it if you own the right to use water, but you should not be able to enlarge your right, or you should not be able to impair the rights of others. And people who have existing rights should have the right to have things remain essentially the same as they always were before the changes occurred, as far as localized interference is concerned. And so some change applications will have to come before us, like based on shares of stock, people go to the company, can I change that? And they'll say, yeah, you can change it, but you need to leave 20% or 10% or 30% in the company to help carry your water so everybody can get their shares. And then we'll release some of the water, take land out of production, and you can do that. What we're looking for is trying to keep a hydrologic balance in the system so that as you move water rights to other uses, there is no more depletion after the change is accomplished than there was before the change was filed. And so sometimes it requires a depletion. Now, we've looked at some of the rights on the Weber River system, and some people refer to it as a haircut. I'm really into haircuts, right? It's a family thing, right? We'll look at sources, and if the source will not provide a full water right for the full year, we'll actually come back and look at commissioners' records. And Jim Wells is our river commissioner on the Weber River system, and he helps keep records. Blaine Johnson was the commissioner for many, many years. We use a lot of his records long-term. Averages of what sources supply. If we show that they're only available 30% of the time, we only may let you change 30% of that water right, because that's really historically on the average all that's available under that water. So it really depends on each individual water right, the impact that it has on the hydrologic system, and what we have to do to protect the downstream users and the local users in the area where you're trying to divert the water. So there's a lot of things that we'll deal with when we look at changes.
You talk about the lack of clay conveying layer, and even though we're pristine now and pretty, you know, really little contamination, no contamination. I'm thinking of Ogden Valley and the UGS study on, you know, septic tank density. Has the health department tuned into this? Do you think this is headed to a septic tank kind of limit, or could that be in the future? What are your thoughts on that?
Is there someone here from the health department? I think, go ahead, Mike.
I think that's something that would be very beneficial to the Valley in the future. The Weber Morgan Health Department hasn't discussed doing that, but there were concerns, which is the reason why Janae did her initial study looking for what the sources of nitrate were. That's something that certainly needs to be done if development continues, and it continues using septic tanks. If we bring in sewer, the issue becomes a lot less important.
Yeah, I think it'll be more and more of a concern as development increases. The more sewage that's dropped into the aquifer, the more contamination potential, and if you're going to do something to take care of that problem.
We have a question over here.
I got one here first. He's been raising that for a while here.
My question is before an application is approved, is a landowner or a businessman or a developer required to pay their back taxes to the county before that application is approved?
There's a county person here. I don't know the answer to that one. Is there a county person that might be able to respond to that?
We can't. We cannot ask, as far as I'm aware, we cannot hold a developer's back taxes. We can't hold what he said. We cannot do that. It's not a
it could be a landowner, too, though. I mean, anyone. It has nothing to do with the application, then, right? If they're into the county for taxes, that has nothing to do with your office or your application.
Okay, one of these really cool last two Supreme Court decisions that should never have been made instructs the state engineer to look at applications and says there's five criteria in Section 7338 to look at, and it's is there an appropriate water? Will you impair the rights of others? Do you have? Is the project physically and financially feasible? Is this filed for purposes of speculation or monopoly? Nowhere in there do I say, have you paid your back taxes? But there might be some financial problems there. If you haven't paid your back taxes, can you even do the project? You might be able to get involved. But it doesn't talk about property taxes or obligations that you have, or you know, if you've kept up on things you're supposed to do, then the county's going to have to make an assessment on whether building permits are issued. That's, we're told that's not one of the criteria that I can read in the statute.
Who was that? Go ahead.
Thank you. I just want to know if the aquifer or the bathtub is constantly monitored and by whom.
The only way we have of monitoring that bathtub is the measurements that we can get from the Gateway Canal and the Weaver River right there at Gateway Canal, the measuring devices we have there, and the inflows we have, the measuring devices we have at East Canyon Dam and at Echo Reservoir. That's the only way we can monitor whether or not the bathtub has slowed down in filling or not. It is definitely not a continuous thing.
How often is it done? But we also have, in conjunction with that, the U.S. Geological Survey, who comes up annually and takes measurements of groundwater levels, and they watch that very closely, and they'll prepare a report each year to kind of show what's happening to our aquifer system, to show whether it's going down or whether, I mean, it's annually they prepare a report to find what's happening there. So in addition to the information that Ross said, that's another so we have to watch what's happening here with the aquifer.
Go ahead.
So this 59,000 that's going out the other end of the valley doesn't include the cottonwood that's coming in and all these other creeks are coming in between them two measuring devices, correct?
That 59,000 number that we're reporting here is ground. What we've done is we've isolated in that number, we've tried to isolate out the surface waters from the groundwater. Okay? We've done a little white paper that basically figures out what we figure the groundwater is contributing to the flows of the Weaver River. So no, it's not in that number. The surface flows from Cotton Creek are not in there. Wow, any other questions?
So you're saying basically that we're using less than 10% of our aquifer. We've got 4,400 acre feet that were allocated in the valley, and we're dumping 59,000 out, so we're using less than 10% of our groundwater. Why is it not being opened up then? Why is it still? I mean, why do you see?
Don't forget that when you say opened up, I'm assuming you're asking about opening it up to new appropriations?
Yeah.
Okay, now remember that you're part of a larger system. You're part of the Weaver River drainage system. There's an amount of water that was allocated by a judge in a decree, okay, to be utilized throughout the entire Weaver River drainage. Your water that's spilling out of that bathtub is contributing to downstream users. They're waiting for that water.
That's allocated already.
Yes. If you take that water, then somebody or some entity is going to need to replace that water.
Okay. Now, I do think we found a time this year for a few weeks that we found some water.
Sure.
We were looking for somebody to take it. Perhaps the presentation wanted.
Texas said they were in
there. So there are times
about it.
Every 30 years or so, you know, when there's some excess water in the system, but really the river is fully allocated by the hundred of years.
So that 59,000 is in a bonus somewhere.
It's water moving through the valley that's here, that's available to be used based on existing rights. But it's going to satisfy some of these rights. If you take some, they got to replace it so that they've got the water.
In the rest
of it. Okay. Yes, sir.
You're talking about this excess water that's coming in. Now this side of the valley, we have several creeks that come in, was never measured, only going out. They're never measured coming in. You start up to the top, you've got Hart's Gravel Creek, you've got Deep Creek, you've got Smith Creek, you've got Dalton Creek, you've got Peterson Creek. All these little creeks come in to the system. They're never monitored. You don't know how much is coming in. They're going on out of the valley. They're not going to the aquifer. They're going out. So that's where all this water, extra water, is coming that you think, oh, we got it down here. It's water that can't be captured or hasn't been able to be captured yet to be used other than just run right on through.
I agree with your statement. Was there a question that I missed, or was that a statement?
Not just a statement.
Okay, I agree. And by the way, I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's very important for surface water right holders to be monitoring and measuring their flows in their surface water. That's the only way we're going to know if somebody punches a well in the hard rock or in the bedrock aquifer. That's the only way we're going to know if they're being affected or not, is if they have some measurement devices. So I encourage you to measure your water and keep as good of records as you possibly can on those surface sources.
State statute requires that everybody using water in the state that they must have an adequate head gate and measuring device in order to use water. State engineers in the past, and I know the current state engineer, is not going to go out to every diversion right now to make sure you've got that, but if there's a conflict and you're concerned about it, boy, this is a strong recommendation. Get measuring devices and measure your water. When we start having problems, we will come and issue orders saying you've got to put those on. It's required by state law, and it's an old state law. Okay? We find we have less problems when people have to measure their water. They know what's there, they know what to share, what they're entitled to. But you need to understand it is a law that if you're using water, you have to be able to control it, you have to be able to measure it. So, but we are not enforcing that or requiring that in every situation right now. We have some areas where we actually are requiring people to do it. We have to have them have a commissioner saying that Jim will go out and actually read those measurements. And I know it would be really tough for you to do your job if we didn't have measurements where you have measurements on the system right now. I mean, there are several measurements to help monitor the system, but every user we don't monitor yet. But it's a good idea to do that, to keep records of what you're using.
You had a moratorium in place while you were doing the study. What happens to that now?
Okay. Do you want to answer that or should I?
What? Go ahead.
What we'll do is we want to leave, and I just brought this slide back up. We want to leave this.
30 days.
Okay. We want to leave this open for public comment for the next 30 days. And we want to evaluate your concerns and your comments that you would have for us. And let's say best case scenario, you do not disagree with what we're trying to accomplish in the administration of the water rights, and we don't get any concerns or comments about it. We could go ahead and implement the policy and continue on doing what we're doing within the next 30 days. If we see some significant issues being raised that we've not seen. Then we may need to come back out here. We may need to deal with those issues. We may need to make some adjustments to our proposal that we put on the slides tonight, and we may need to come back out here and change that just a little bit and tell you what we've done, and then we could implement it at that time. So I guess the short answer to your question is 30 days.
So we would not want to do anything for 30 days. We'll wait until comments come in, and then we will move ahead with the policies.
We were basically had the same question coming to us now of when we would start opening up, and our answer is we're going to do as we're told. And as soon as the Division of Water Rights determines that that is the correct way to go about it, then we'll open up next day.
Okay. Good. We're on the same page.
But we want to make sure we get your comments in and give due consideration to any concerns that you might have. And if your concerns are, we ought to go ahead with this, you know, we're happy to hear that, too. That just whatever you'd like us to consider, that's what we want to give you the opportunity to do.
Well, I had this guy raise in and two more over there.
Just want to make sure that I understand this correctly here. A couple of years ago, there was a very influential organization within the area that filed on an exchange of 240-acre feet of water from East Canyon down into the Mountain Green area. This person's interest is up into the bedrock. Okay, so the way I understand the state's proposal, that if that ever did get approved, that would be pumped from the Valley Flow Aquifer up into the bedrock? How do I understand that?
Okay, good. Very good question. Fair question. Ideally, that's what I'd love to see, okay, because we think there's some water that could be pumped up there. But remember, when I laid that proposed policy out, I did not state that somebody could not punch a hole in the bedrock aquifer. They would simply need to help us understand why that new hole and its fractures that it's intercepting are not going to take water from an already over-appropriated surface creek or source. So it's still an option, but they're going to have to show us how that's going to function.
What we don't want is people moving up above diversions where people are really dependent on water, pumping water out under this exchange agreement, and now these people don't have their water and they can't get it exchanged. So we're going to want to have some evidence, but you're not going to hurt anybody by doing that.
Okay, maybe two more, or I want everybody to feel like they got their voice here, so go ahead.
Okay, you've established requirements for drilling in bedrock, and so obviously there are a few requirements for valley fill, but if we are downstream or down aquifer from that, what recourse do we have if we see a significant change in our water? Is there anything that we have as water users that we've had our shares for a long time? Do we have a recourse? Because it doesn't sound like there's a lot of requirements for valley fill.
Okay. The first answer I'm going to give you, you're not going to want to hear, but it's a legal recourse. You have a legal recourse if somebody's interfering with your water right, with a prior right. Now, none of us like to go to court, and none of us like to spend money on attorneys, but that is a legal, you do have a legal recourse. Now, if you've kept good data over time, and that's all what you're basically doing is you're building up evidence to show that there has been some interference occurring, perhaps you would have enough information to show us, and we would be able to step in and regulate or do something to help out the situation. However, your last recourse is a legal recourse. Kent, do you want to add to that?
One of the criteria they've talked about in judging applications is that it does not impair the rights of others. And so we are required to advertise applications that we feel might impair the rights of others, and we will continue to do that in those areas where we think rights might be impaired. It'll be a public notification. You want to watch that notification. If you've got concern, file a protest. We're concerned with it, so we'll look at that. We're going to keep looking at groundwater monitoring information to see what the aquifer is doing. If we start seeing problem areas, we're going to be a little hesitant to approve them. We hope to hear from people. If we've got problems, let us know. If we tried to take one well and pull 59,000 acre feet out of just one spot, everybody, well, the fact the home's probably around to get sucked in. We will see some problems there. So, you know, the water's going to have to be spread out, so we're going to look. If we start having declines in a particular area, we're going to be less inclined to approve more wells there. We're going to say, well, we need to spread them out. There's water moving through this system, but it's not all right at this point. So we're going to watch that, and we want to hear from everybody about their concerns. Now, we did have a situation where we approved a well in the West Farmington area, and we've had a few calls come in saying that water rights are being impaired. The water in their well has dropped several feet, and they want us to come out and figure out what's happening. Well, Farmington City actually had the well right that we approved. We called them to see what was happening, how much they're pumping. They said, well, what we did is drove the well rig onto the property and parked it, and they haven't even started drilling the well yet. And yet, everybody's well started. Okay, well, so we will listen to what people say, but we will check to make sure it's a credible statement. I'm not doing some investigation, but it's funny because the same, everybody's wells is starting to go down, but all they did was just drive the truck. You know. Since they drilled the well, they haven't had any problems.
One more.
Well, I kind of have a question along those same lines. We obviously, there's a lot of irrigation ditches up here, and a lot of those ditches do affect people's wells. And it's getting to be, as more people move in here and are building big homes, they don't want an irrigation ditch behind their house, that they're trying to take the water out of them and make sure that it either stays in the pipeline or in the river or something to that effect. What is your right as a landowner with that ditch, especially if it's affecting a well, of letting them take the waterfront and not allowing you to use that ditch anymore?
I guess my first response to that would be, are you seeing this happen, or is your well going down because of
not
lining
up
ditches?
Not me personally, but yeah, I can show you people that have a problem with that.
Okay. And my second statement would be, we can't encourage people to waste water. Or we can't tell people, you can't improve your conveyance system because you need to let water seep into the ground. We can't make them do that. Now, in other places in my region, for example, Beaver and Shingle Creek Irrigation Company up in Camas area, they actually, when they do a change application, they require that a certain amount of the water that they do a change application on stay in the system for carrier water in their ditches. That is an option for irrigation companies to do. But as far as us telling a person you can't improve the quality of your conveyance system, we can't do that.
And there's actually a Supreme Court case that's entitled New Escalante Irrigation versus Steeds. The Steed family had a water right on a little side canyon down below the feeder ditch at the U.S. Line Irrigation Company feeding their ditch, and it seeped. The ditch leaked. It ran into this side channel, and then it ran for many years. The Steed family filed applications on that water, and they actually had a farm operation going with that seepage water coming into the side drain. The U.S. Line Irrigation Company came in and said, we're losing a lot of water in our feeder ditch. They piped it all the way from their source all the way down to their distribution system. Within a very short time, the Steed's side drains dried up. They had no more water. They took New Escalante to court. Supreme Court came back and said, we cannot require people to be inefficient, just like Ross said, in their delivery methods of water. Steed's, I'm sorry, but your water was based on them wasting water. As long as they wasted it, you could use it. But if they're not wasting it, you are not entitled to it.
I have another question, not along those same lines, but when you talk about good data, if you, for instance, we have a spring that has been there forever, is Grandpa good data?
Sure.
That he knows that spring has run his whole entire life?
Sure. Okay. You don't have to hire a professional to come and take measurements for you. As long as they're accurate and verifiable, it's good data.
Okay.
I had a grandpa that couldn't find his way home. It would be bad. I mean, grandpa has a good source.
My grandpa's a very good source. Not my grandpa. This grandpa's talking about the good source.
But if grandpa would have written down this year, this is where it was. This year, we actually saw that it was this deep in the stream and kept those kind of records. That's a lot better than remembering or having a memory kind of fade. I remember having a hearing here on the Weaver River system where some gentleman
it was like 97 years old, but we had a water out here that was conducting. We actually brought recording devices and everything because I wanted to get his testimony. He's still really sharp, he can remember. And who can remember back, you know, 97 years? And we just thought that was very important to get that on record and record it. And so, yeah, we do use a lot of that. But it would be better to have a gauging station and a measuring device and documentation of this is what happened this day and this day. I mean, just to
right, going forward.
Yeah, so the better information you've got. But, yeah, we have to use a lot of grandpa's memories as we start looking at what to protect and how to take care of things in the state. It wasn't our grandpa.
No. Okay. I turn the time back over to Kent and let him wrap it up, I guess. Thank you, guys.
Okay. Want to thank you very much for coming. We do value your input. Thanks to the UGS for the great study that's done and the information pulled together. It's helped us formulate where we think we ought to go with this. Appreciate River Basin and their contribution to the study and making it possible to be able to pull this data together so that we can make some decisions.
So we're going to put this on a website something?
Yes. In fact, actually, I think the UGS, all of the information on the PowerPoint we're going to have available on our website. We'll have Ross's information available on the website. Any comments we get, we'll have it posted on the website. What else do we post? Well, we try to post everything on
these minutes from this meeting.
The minutes from the meeting, we'll post that on the website. The website is?
Go back one. I don't want to do that. waterrights.utah.gov, but I'll put it back up there real quick.
There it is.
waterrights.utah.gov.
And we'll get the information, or you can go there and you can look at all of this information. We'll try to get it posted just as quickly as you can. Thank you so much. We look forward to your comments. And we'll leave the record open again for 30 days. If you want to make a comment, to us, we'd also like to thank the committee for helping accommodate the rooms and making the panelists to be here and starting to request a few years ago. I'm not going to be able to do that.